Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
The narrative we're told, for the most part, culturally in the States, is that creativity, creative projects, creative pursuits, your art, is the thing you get to when you're done being responsible. So if you're responsible enough to the machinery that pays rent, that, you know, that pays taxes, if you're responsible enough to the machinery, then you earn the right long term to do the things that are actually best in you that you desire and you love. That's the narrative. And it's freaking everywhere. It's like, it's, and there aren't like specific places from whence this thing comes, but it's absolutely everywhere. And you couldn't find a college student who doesn't feel that pressure to like get the degree you're supposed to get so you can make the money you're supposed to make so that eventually maybe you can retire and maybe enjoy your freaking life. Whereas like the thing I started doing early on was like, there are things in me that I want to tell stories. I want to get on stage and make people laugh. Like I want to, these creative things that are in me, these creative ideas, like I'm going to bank on these and live my life this way.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Justin, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I am happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I found out about you and your work by way of your publicist who told me about your book, It's What You Make of It, It Is What You Make of It, Creating Something Great from What You've Been Given. And I think what intrigued me most about your story was that you're this sort of multi-hyphenate person who's a pastor, musician, and you do all these sort of things, you know, as well as being an artist. But before we get into all of that, given that you're a pastor, I wanted to start by asking, what religious or spiritual beliefs were you raised with, and how did those end up impacting the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Good question. So I wasn't really raised with anything directly. My mother grew up Catholic, and she had sort of the dust of her religious practice around the house and like some of the artifacts, but there wasn't any sort of regular religious training or conversation in her household. It was a little bit shied away from. My dad was not vehemently anti, but was not for it. That religion was for weak people, for weak-minded people. It was a thing that you needed if you needed it. But up until the point you need it, then don't. So it's fine for other folks, but you're strong, so don't. I wasn't really raised with it. When I started my faith journey, I was like kind of 17, 18 or so. And the things that have informed me since then have a lot to do with not knowing that I've never felt the pressure to get it. That my religious training was one of process and growth. And so I've never felt a real push to come to really solid conclusions about a whole lot. That's been a pretty significant portion or significant aspect of my religious training.
Yeah. What is it that prompted your faith journey? At 17 seems like a really young age to begin a faith journey.
I saw the life of someone else who I really admired, not for any like really hyper specific reason, but I liked the way I liked the way he related with other people. I liked the peace I found in him as a friend. I was struck by his willingness to make room for me in his life. And I wanted to know what made someone like that tick. And he said that it was his faith. And so I decided to give that a shot. Ultimately, really was that. Like, I didn't have some sort of moment. I didn't have a revelation. I didn't come to the end of some intellectual process and thought, okay, I got it. I was honest to God, like, intrigued by someone else's life. And I decided to figure out, like, okay, if that works for you, I like you. What would that look like to work for me? And I've been on that road kind of ever since.
Well, I think the thing that struck me most about what you said is that you haven't come to any sort of absolute conclusions. And that's one of the things I think I've always resisted about organized religion. That and the fact that I'm Indian and all Indian religious traditions are really time consuming and kind of mind numbing.
Yes.
And what I wonder, is what do you think people misunderstand about people of tremendous faith? Because I think that, you know, from the outsider perspective or somebody like me or, you know, somebody who's like your dad, we basically see people who are extremely religious as sort of fanatics who don't think for themselves, who, you know, need somebody to tell them what to do. And, you know, given that I'm talking to you, I'm pretty sure that's not accurate. Those are my own biases at work. So what do you think that, you know, those of us who aren't particularly religious misunderstand about the people who are?
The way I would say it would be that some of the assumptions I would want to chase down and murder with a blunt weapon are things like that religious people aren't conflicted. They are. Everybody is. Because that's the shape of the human soul, is like you're at conflict with yourself regularly. It's part of what it means to grow and mature and evolve as a human. It's like who you were the day before, what you thought the day before, or the week before, the year before. It changes. And that means that you're often in conflict with yourself. Also, there isn't a way in which we don't entertain new information without being conflicted if it comes in conflict with previous understandings of the world. Everyone is conflicted. Which takes you to the second part is, and I don't mean to make everyone who's part of a religious system a victim, but the systemization of religious practice does make it really difficult to live as a conflicted individual. That a lot of what ends up happening is the desire to live in allegiance with the tribe and not to be kicked out, which is like, that's just evolution. Like you find a tribe, you find safety in the tribe, and you want to stay in the tribe because that's where safety, protection, and flourishing is. A lot of why the hyper-religious come off so damn secure is you kind of have to, or you feel at least like you have to, in order to remain part of the tribe. It's not actually true. It's not actually what's going on in the soul. That would be the primary assumption I would want to chase down. It's like, yeah, maybe this person does come off like entirely settled on all of these massive issues that are wildly conflicted issues. They're not. They're actually not. And given safety, and given, I'll just use the word, given safety, given grace, given time, given attention, given opportunity, everybody becomes more human in relationship to other humans.
Hmm. Well, what about the assumption that religious people are prudish? That, you know, these are people who don't have any fun. They don't, you know, do, you know, any drugs or drink, or not that that's necessarily what it means to have fun, but the assumption that, oh, these people just don't have vices and, you know, they're holier than thou. Like, is that completely inaccurate? And,
no.
And what about you? Are you a person who has vices?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I don't, how should I say, this is actually a fascinating question. So, on the one hand, yes, I think it's a pretty fair assumption to make that a lot of religious folks end up prudish in response to or in relationship to like moral education. Like what does it look like to live well? And specifically, what does it look like to avoid things? That's where prudishness comes from, right? It's not necessarily always that the thing itself is bad, that sex is bad. It oftentimes does come from a place of like you could get hurt there. And so perhaps it would be better. So like sex before marriage, as an example, like it's one thing to, and I understand, it's one thing to be like, well, you know, that's that's old timey thought, et cetera. The other side of the coin is like the amount of trauma there is in young persons, particularly young women before they turn 27, that comes in the context of, like untrained, or uncared for sexual experiences is pretty significant. And so like some of that prudishness isn't necessarily prudishness. Some of it is actually fair warning. So, it's not always just like, oh, you're prudish and you shouldn't be. Sometimes it's like, yeah, there really are actual early warning signs about certain behaviors or functions in the world that like can be really freaking damaging to people. And are there more loving ways to approach those conversations than just saying, don't drink, don't smoke, don't hang out with girls who do? Yes, absolutely. There are better ways to approach that. But some of those warnings, a lot of those warnings are really, really freaking fair.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, that makes me wonder what role, you know, our modern media plays in the narrative that we have about religion.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you look, you know, in one way, religion has been the source of so many conflicts in the world. You know, as an Indian person, I know that that's the primary source of, you know, the conflict that India has with Pakistan in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And that has been going on for 30 years. And
I think about the number of wars. Yeah,
that
I think I would push back and say, I would flip that. I've had the conversation a bit. I would push back and say, I don't know that religion would be the driving reason so much as it is oftentimes the most available and convenient and pervasive justification. That the reasons we actually tend to go to war in actuality are sometimes personal, but oftentimes they're economic. They're mostly economic. That religion tends to be like the pervasive justification for that. So whether you're talking about like, you know, I was listening to the NPR report this morning that, you know, the president of the United States is meeting with the Israeli prime minister. I can't remember the Israeli prime minister's new name, but not that he has anyways. And, you know, like it's really easy to jump to like, well, it's you know, because it's it has this long religious history that. It's about being Jewish and it's about being non-Jewish, that it's about being Muslim. And without pretending like I'm a full-blown expert, my experience in conversation with folks who work in those conflicts is that the religious differences are actually there, but the occupations come because it's an economic decision and it's a cultural identity decision. And the religion part ends up being like the easiest, most pervasive justification that I can get over doing the thing that I want to do, that I really want to do. Like Israel wants to possess this land, and that's an economic decision that's to some degree justified by religion, but not entirely rooted there. But then it's justified in the narrative by religion, which makes it easier to do and get support for it. That's been my experience and my philosophy.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. So, you know, this is just a fascinating conversation to me because my parents have become more religious as they've gotten older. And there was a time when, you know, they would fight me on this. And now their request is just go to the temple on New Year's. And that's all we'll ask, with some occasional requests to like attend pujas and things like that, because yes, all our religious traditions are ridiculously long. But my bigger issue with a lot of Indian religious traditions is that they sound more like superstition than faith. There's no explanation for any of them. So the one I always come back to is, for 20 plus years, I have been told that you're not supposed to get your hair cut on Tuesdays. And I believe that to the point where, even though I know it's nonsense, I still won't go get my hair cut on Tuesday because I have this, you know, ridiculous.
Do you know what the root of that is?
Well, so I've looked for this. So first I asked, you know, some guys at an ashram in India that run a surf camp /ashram. And one of them said, oh, well, barbershops in India are closed on Tuesdays. And I was like, that's ridiculous. We live in America. Lived in America for 25 years. Right. And I was like, that's not enough. I'm not going to go, you know, I'm not going to settle there. So like, okay, why are barbershops closed? So I went to Google, which led me to Quora, and the answers were absolutely ridiculous. Barbers need days off too. They need days to sharpen their tools after cutting all that hair. I mean, and okay, so I've never been able to find an explanation. And my mother has no explanation for so many of our religious traditions. And she said, this is just what we do. And so that's one issue that I have. So one, you know, how do we end up with these sort of narratives around faith that nobody has any explanations for? And then two, how do we get into situations of extremism where people become fanatical?
So the one question, how do we get into these situations? This is not just a religious pattern. It's true in romantic relationship. It's true in business dealings. It's true in economics. Is we end up doing things because they've worked in the past. And actually really, not that I like the answer as an answer, but you know, your friend's answer is like, well, because they're closed on Tuesdays. Well, they're closed on Tuesdays because of the belief that you shouldn't get your hair cut on Tuesday. Like that's why we end up there, is because you had this belief. And at some point we do lose touch with what might have been a very real or very helpful suggestion about how to live best. So who the hell knows? But maybe at some point there was like this, maybe it was as simple as like the Jewish Sabbath day. We're like, listen, for barbers, let's just make it Tuesday. And because these people do need some rest, maybe it was as simple as that. And this is part of why I do what I do, but because there's this storytelling absence, the absence of storytelling, we just kind of do the task. We lose touch with the heart of the suggestion or the heart of the instruction. That's part of how we get to like just doing crap because we do crap. It's because it's been done that way. But at some point, someone made a decision. And I just believe this about human people. At some point, someone made a decision because they honest to God thought it was best. Like I don't buy the notion that just people just create systems of control just to do so. I think 99% of the time, yes, there's huge jerks in the world who create systems of control to do so because they want to have power, because they want to shape the world in their image and all that kind of stuff. I get it. That's true. most of the time, folks are making the best that they can with what they have on hand. And then we lose touch. We lose the thread somewhere down the line. We end up just kind of doing things in repetition just because we do them and we forget why. That's one. The second part is like, how do we get to extremism? this will be a really cheap answer. And there are way better people like Jeremy Courtney who can dig into this kind of thing with way more history. But traumatized people. Hurt people. That's true on the personal level. That's true in leadership. That's true in religion. It's true in business. It's true in every facet of the world. So is it, if you put a traumatized, injured, hurt, scared little boy who grows up into his 40s, 50s, and 60s at the head of a multi-billion-dollar, international conglomerate, he'll probably create a business model and business practices that are relatively abusive and usury of the people who are subservient to him. That's part of how we get to what I would suggest is a very unspoken form of his extremism, which is the one in which like we are constantly semi-enslaving people to 60 to 80 hours of work to the bottom line of some corporate company that makes widgets. We get to extremism because people are unhealthy and don't do their damn work. That's kind of it. Like that happens in relationships where if you don't do your work, you're going to hurt the people you're with. And it happens in business leadership and it happens in religious leadership. These aren't people who are necessarily just following the edicts of their religion and thereby become extremists. They're broken humans who have been granted or handed or taken immense amounts of power and are utilizing the justifications of their religion to propagate violence on people in the name of their religion. They're injured people, and so they pass on injury.
Yeah, so it's funny because as you were saying that, I couldn't help but think about the Branch Davidians. I grew up, in Texas from 1986 to 1983, and I very distinctly remember the sort of ambush at Waco happened when I was a freshman in high school and watching it on TV. And what I wonder, you mentioned the people who are these kinds of leaders are hurt. How is it that people become so susceptible to following somebody like this? I mean, I know they're incredibly charismatic because we did an entire series of cults and they build these sort of, cults of personality around themselves. But, these aren't complete idiots who end up in these situations. Yeah. Like reasonably intelligent people find themselves in situations like this all the time.
Yes. And then we go back to you can be as intelligent as you want to be. You can be as well informed in every aspect of your life as you want to be, but there are aspects of your soul and your psychology that remain soft and susceptible to manipulation. There is no imperviousness to the need for community and relationship. And so sometimes this is a really lonely human being who's incredibly intelligent, but it's susceptible because they're lonely. Or maybe this is a wildly intelligent, generally stable human being who's desperate for some kind of purpose. Or maybe this is a brilliant human being who's got a sense of purpose in the life, but there's some kind of deep trauma somewhere back there it's really being a human being is an incredibly complex and incredibly difficult thing to do well and healthily. And how should I say this? The journey towards health is long. The journey towards health is arduous, and power tends to overwhelm that process. So the thing that all of these charismatic leaders and abusive faith leaders tend to have in common is they're powerful in some way, shape, or form. That can either be by way of weaponry and cultural weaponry, or that can be by way of articulation. They're influential, there's a power that they wield, and that power tends to overwhelm and bypass actual processes of health and growth.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, speaking of health and growth, why is it that people turn to organized religion? Because I know, in my family, one of the things I've seen with my parents is that almost all of our family friends in Riverside, California, where I'm from, were the result of our temple. And I realized for my parents, religion is actually a form of community, but I'm wondering, what are the other reasons that people turn to organized religion, particularly the people that are, in your congregations?
It's a deep, I think, fundamental human need for purpose, for connection, a place to feel like an actual place, to feel a sense of rooted belonging. The same way that we live in, if to some degree, the same reason we live in neighborhoods. Some people don't. Some people prefer to live way the hell out. Most of us prefer to live in neighborhoods. Some of us live in neighborhoods much closer to other folks. There is a deep, deep human capacity, need, desire, drive to be connected. There's also a deep, we are meaning-making machines, right? So we're either inventing our own meaning or we're chasing our own meaning. But the need for meaning is regardless, like ever present. There is no way to escape either, like the need for meaning in the pursuit of a whole in human life. The only choices we really have there are like, are we making it up? And that's fine. We're creating meaning for ourselves so that there is a sense of meaning. And that's great. And if that's what's going on, then do it really, really well and be highly responsible for it. And or that need for me to create some sense of meaning is actually rooted in the desire I have for like some kind of fundamental, actual, at root, deep, like, you know, existential meaning that there actually is that my soul is designed to find. Either way, I function on community and I function on meaning. I don't really function otherwise. We live our lives with other people because we really, really want to need to. And we chase meaning in some way, shape, or form. So how do people end up in organized religion? Because organized religion is a way to say both those things are true and good and we want to make room for them.
Mm, wow. So one last question around religion. How has your own sort of faith journey changed with age and your sort of understanding of these concepts?
All the time. I really honestly did. I came into the joy in which I was never asked to come to particular conclusions or land specific places. And so it's not been fluid per se where it's like I'm loosey goosey and like anything goes. I have been on a long and continue to be on a long and really good journey, process, evolution. I'm growing. And so with age, the primary difference is like I'm a little bit slower to say things I think might be helpful. That's one. Because I've generally been in a position of leadership in my religious journey. So with age, I'm a little bit slower to say things that I think might be helpful because I want to make sure they're actually helpful. With age, I am far more, I'm far more comfortable with conflict in myself and like recognize them as actual conflicts religiously. Like, I don't really know. And not even the peaceful, like, I don't really know. One of my spiritual directors said recently, she said, it's probably better for you to say something like, I don't know right now, which is actually better. But like, it's not even just that I'm more comfortable not knowing things. I've always been comfortable not knowing things. I've oftentimes been uncomfortable with like actual conflicts in me, cause it causes stress. But I'm more comfortable with some of the actual things in me that like, that stress me out, not understanding or knowing or having a grasp on. So I'm slower to speak the older I get, and I'm more comfortable with the ways that some of my conflicts are actually problematic inside my own soul.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Yeah. Well, what, outside of the sort of start at 17 on your faith journey has led you down this trajectory of your career? I mean, as a musician and all the other things you, I mean, what's been the trajectory of how you got here to the point where you're a writer, a musician, and, pastor?
I'm going to die at some point. And before I do, I want to give away absolutely everything I possibly can of who I am so that my life has been and will have been a gift. That's it.
So, when did you make that? When did you come to that conclusion?
That I was going to die?
Well, obviously that part, but not, everybody knows they're going to die. Most people don't come to the conclusion that, they're going to
I think a lot of people don't actually imagine they really will, but that's actually true. Early on. So I've experienced a fair amount of death around me. So, by the time I was in my mid-20s, I'd been to 20 plus funerals of people who were not like three or four persons removed. It wasn't like my Aunt Judy's best friend's dog's dog walker. It was like friends, best friends, lovers. Like I'd seen just a crap ton of people die. And knowing that the life was as short as it was, I also paired that with I have these gifts and talents and I want to put them somewhere. And that just the math just made sense really early on. And I decided, I don't know if there was a moment, but I decided before I left high school, somewhere in the middle of high school, I'm going to do something in the direction of the performing arts. I was never going to go get a job just to get a job. I was going to do some sort of something that had to do with relationship and communication. And it was not going to make a whole lot of money, but I was going to go do it because it was going to be meaningful and connected. So I don't know when it actually clicked. It feels like it's kind of always been there.
So let's talk about the music piece, because I think that, you said you knew you were going to pursue a career in the performing arts. And as I've said 1,000 times before, you go into the arts knowing that nothing is guaranteed and anything is possible. So knowing all that, was your initial goal to become a pastor or to become a musician?
I don't know if I drew a hard line between those two things, to be honest with you. The musician thing came about because it was afforded me as an opportunity. Leaving high school, I thought I was going to do theater. And then didn't. And I was working with a group of people to plant a church. And so I was doing some pastoring work that I continued to do for 15, 20 years. And then I was afforded the opportunity to go on tour and cut a record because my landlord invited me. This story is actually in the book, because my landlord invited me to consider playing music. So I don't know that I drew a hard line between I'm going to go do this and here's my decision. I was taking the opportunities to some degree as they came along. The general impetus was I'm going to use the gifts and talents I have. I talk and I'm okay at it. and I was learning to play music and I was getting better at songwriting. I'm a storyteller. I wanted to do that. Like, I was taking the things that I had on hand and I just committed pretty early on to do something with my gifts and talents. And that found its way into, like I said, for a minute, it was theater. And then it was like pastoring and teaching and, you know, song leading in a church context. And then it was like song, you know, songwriting and singing and performing and storytelling. And then it became more just strict storytelling and retreat leading and then authoring. And now I run a podcast. And it's been sort of like, there haven't been like hard lines where I've said like, okay, I'm done with this. I'm moving on. And here's the thing I want to do. Opportunities just continue to present themselves to some degree. I think the thing I want to say, which I've been hesitating to say, like, I've just been paying attention. Like I early on, I looked up and someone was handing me the opportunity to get on a stage with a microphone and pretend that I was Black Elk so that I can educate people about the annihilation of a race of people in the United States. And I wanted to take that. And so I did that. So I was a performing, I was a theater person. And then I was offered the opportunity by someone else to step into the lives of a bunch of young adults who were trying to figure out what it looked like to believe in the divine and to like live right and healthily. And I was like, okay, I'll use my talents to do that. And then I was handed the opportunity to do the same thing with teenagers. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then I was handed the opportunity to do that with a guitar and a microphone and on and on and on. And I recognized the opportunities as they were coming along. I haven't actually sought out a whole lot. I have received my opportunities as they've come, which is to say I've been paying attention and I recognize them when they came through the door.
Yeah. Well, two questions. You mentioned having seen a lot of people die who were close to you at a young age.
And yes.
One thing I wonder is why it takes something like a tragedy for people to have some sort of a wake-up call meant to confront their mortality.
That's a great question. I don't know that it always does. I know that in my case, again, you know, we are meaning making machines. We are held together by narrative. Human life is held together by narrative. We need story. Like, it's not just like we tell stories when we're done doing our business. We do our business because of the narrative that we believe. Like, everything runs on the story that we believe about ourselves. And one of the stories, or part of the story, I'm told as a young, straight, white male, really actually had to do with like imperviousness, that I was impervious. That, like, I mean, the stories that you get told, whether it's television or books to some degree, but specifically like early media, like, these people live forever. I mean, you know, how old is Batman? Like, it's like, you know, Batman's been like a really healthy 38-year-old guy for about 55 years. Like, the narratives we tell inform the way we understand our own lives. And the narratives that I was passed as a young white male had nothing to do with getting older. That's why people have such a damn hard time with the fact that they do get older, is because their legends and their stories, you know, Jennifer Aniston doesn't age, so maybe there's something wrong with me that I do. Like, these are the narratives we believe. We don't actually get told stories about death. I did not get told stories about death early. They just came crashing through the freaking window. And that's part of why it's necessary. I had to be told a different narrative. But there just aren't a lot of people, let's be honest. It doesn't sell real well to be like, we're going to do an 8-week series about dying well. And we're going to do this for our young adults. So if you're between the age of 17 and 23, we're going to do 8 weeks on death and dying well. We're going to tell you how to put together a will. And we're going to tell you like how to plan for your 30s and 40s, how to plan for your freaking 20s in light of the fact that like at the end of your 20s, you're really only going to have about 25 functional years with your body left. So don't be an idiot. Like, no one's having that conversation with people early on, especially me, because it's like they would rather use the energy I have in my teens and 20s to sell all the crap they're trying to sell instead of teaching me to live well. So it takes death to break me out of the patterns, because no one's actually telling a responsible story about it.
No. The other thing is, you know, I feel like there's so many people who have talents and gifts who hesitate to express them, start to believe that they're not creative or don't have a creative bone in their body, which is nonsense because everybody's creative. Why do you think that is, and how do we unwind that narrative?
By telling better stories and by taking the risks to execute on them. I mean, a part of why I do what I do is that I get to get in. I mean, it was just in Florida and I did this for a room of people. I mean, I'd get to tell pieces of my story in which I've been taking risks financially, economically, and socially since I left my house as a teenager. And I do that to try to, again, hopefully tell an inspiring story that someone else would maybe want to adopt as an aspect or an element of their own. The narrative we're told, for the most part, culturally in the States, is that creativity, creative projects, creative pursuits, your art, in a sense, the big way to say it, your art is the thing you get to when you're done being responsible. So if you're responsible enough to the machinery that pays rent, that, you know, that pays taxes, if you're responsible enough to the machinery, then you earn the right long term to do the things that are actually best in you that you desire and you love. That's the narrative. And it's freaking everywhere. It's like, it's, and there aren't like specific places from whence this thing comes, but it's absolutely everywhere. And you couldn't find a college student who doesn't feel that pressure to like get the degree you're supposed to get so you can make the money you're supposed to make so that eventually maybe you can retire and maybe enjoy your freaking life. Whereas like the thing I started doing early on was like, there are things in me that I want to tell stories. I want to get on stage and make people laugh. Like I want to these creative things that are in me, these creative ideas, like I'm going to bank on these and live my life this way. And so the way hopefully we move people away from thinking that they're not creative or that's not worth it is by telling stories, not just putting products in the world as creative folks, but telling the story about how did you get there? What risks did you take? How much did it cost you? Did you make money on that first project? Did you not? When you didn't make money on that first project, did you get a loan out? How much is a loan? Are you still paying it off? Like telling the story of what it looks like to live that way, because everyone knows what it looks like to go to college, get the damn job, barely pay rent, maybe get married, have some kids, make life more expensive, and die unhappy. We're very familiar with that story. The other story is not a really well-told story, and the details are really, really mysterious. So I would rather say, I made money on my first record. I lost a crap ton of money on my second record. Let's talk about the difference. I'd rather get into that.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes a perfect segue into the book. So what is it that prompted you to write this book of all the books that you could write?
Two reasons. One, because I had two books in the queue. One had to do with the relationship between work and rest. And the other one was this series of stories about not buying it is what it is, but actually taking what I have on hand and making something good with it. And when the final decision ultimately was made, when in March, early March of 2020, all of my jobs left the table, and I had actually literally zero idea where any of my money was going to come from over the course of the next year, or beyond. And I knew that I was going to have to reinvent. I knew that I was going to have to pick up scraps. I knew that I was going to have to like dig deeper into the same pattern I've been living in, which is like, okay, what do I have to work with? Because I'm not going to quit trying to be an artist. I knew that. No. I'm like, I'm not going to go get a job at a cafe. I'm not going to start trading day stocks. I'm not going to do that crap. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing because I'm going to die and I'm going to leave the best I have on the table by the time I do. And because I knew that was true in me, I also knew that there would be a whole lot of folks who were facing the same thing about the things that they were doing that they cared about, because a lot of that went away too. So I decided to put this book in the world instead of the one about rest and work because I wanted to meet the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that makes a perfect setup to talking about one of the very first things that you say in the book, which is that there are no dead ends for artists. Dead ends are simply more radical and challenging invitations to create a way forward.
Yes.
And I think that there are a lot of people who see dead ends as dead ends and give up. And then there are people who see dead ends the way you do. What do you think is the difference between those two people?
Experience, leadership, failure, time, effort. You got to try. So, the image in my head right now is, I mean, you come to the end of some roadway and there's, you know, the railing that's there. And if you're with someone who's jumped the railing before, you're more apt to jump the railing with that person. Because what the railing says and the end of the roadway says, again, as a narrative, you come to the end of a road and the end of the road says, this is the end of the road. And it takes usually watching someone else jump the railing and continue on, and then, you know, pull the machete out of their backpack and start creating their own pathway forward. It takes watching someone else do it, which is to say, it takes artists who are willing to communicate a little bit more about their own process and their own history.
So another thing that you say in the book is that I'd rather make garbage work while honoring and maintaining great relationships than creating best-selling work while becoming the kind of person that nobody wants to be around. And yes. I think that that really struck me because I, you know, like there's almost no artist who would actually say, you know what, I'd rather have lousy work, you know, even if it means I'm going to be around great people, than, hey, I want to, you know, write a bestseller. Like that's such a counterintuitive way to think about things. Why, like what prompted that?
Again, that has a lot to do with like knowing that my life's going to end and knowing what I'm going to feel like when it's over to some degree. Really, honestly, a lot of my life philosophy comes from the recognition that it ends. And yeah, I want to put great work in the world. I also recognize that the great work I put in the world is going to be a byproduct of an extension, a growth that comes out of me being healthy. Me being healthy has to do with being in loving and caring relationships. So that's a little bit antithetical. Like the sacrifices one of the stories that I think you read in the book is like, I got this project done and it cost me a relationship. And the product is okay. And it wasn't worth the having lost the relationship. And I just never wanted to do that again. And part of the reason it's not that great a project is because over the course of the last like 4 or 5 months we were working on it, he and I weren't getting along. And so like there's a direct correlation between having like being in and executing and loving, caring relationships and actually making great work. It's really the same question.
Well, so it's funny because I've had experiences where I have, you know, outgrown people that I was working with, and that became a source of conflict. And there were moments while building an Unmistakable Creative where we were having to choose between the future of the company and a really big project and the relationship with somebody who worked with us. And, you know, not through our own doing, it cost us the relationship. I've always regretted that. And at the same time, the project would have never gotten made. I feel like it's not that black and white in my mind.
No, it's not. It's all wrapped up together. And the reason I present it that way is in the book with like, I would rather make crap work and have loving relationships is because the focus on being a healthy person long-term kind of is the ball game. So creating work regularly is part of how I maintain my own health. Like this is in me to do. So I stay healthy in part by making good work and by executing on work. And the health that I bring to the table as an artist is about the health of my relationships. If I'm not well in my relationships, if I'm not well in general as a person, if I'm disconnected from people, I'm not going to make as good work. So the goofy kind of like half-assed stories we tell about like, well, you have Van Gogh and like all these tortured artist types, like that's really cute. One, like we've got like barely 10 years of Van Gogh's work, and I'm just not of the opinion that like he wouldn't have made even better work had he gotten his crap together, got himself emotionally stabilized and like lived deeper into his life. We would have more Van Gogh and it would probably be better. So I don't buy the direct correlation between unhealthy folks and their art. I think that's trash. I think these are highly talented people who are being unhealthy and whose talents would have been even more rightly fine tuned in health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the other things that really struck me that you talked about was this difference between, you know, being celebrated for your achievements and actually loving the work that you do. And, mm-hmm. you know, we live in a world that, you know, puts everybody's accomplishments on public display through social media. And yet, you know, I think that there's this sort of conflict almost of, you know, wanting to love your work, but also seeking validation for it.
Yeah. Do both. I think what other people think about your work matters. Just be careful who those folks are. So like having layers, one of the things I'll coach artists in is like, you'll have layers. Like if there are people in your life who know your work and you show them something and they're like, that's not very good. That should mean something. like, don't ignore that. Don't always go Romeo and Juliet, where, like, if you have a different opinion than the people around you, they're all wrong. No, they're probably right. So if there are people who are familiar with your work and care about you, have some folks around you who are like, hey, this is the thing I'm working on, and they have an opinion about it, and it makes a difference. And then there's the next layer of folks who are maybe more like fans who have been on board for a while. And if, you know, if you put something in the world and your immediate fans, like, you know, Kevin Kelly's whole 1,000 people, if those 1,000 people don't resonate with what you're doing, then yeah, you might have missed, because the art you're putting in the world is an extension of relationship and an expression of relationship. And so if you missed in relationship, you want to readjust. And then there's a layer beyond that where, like, you're making new fans and just kind of general, you know, people are paying attention to the arts, and maybe those opinions really shouldn't matter much at all. So I think both things happen at the same time. I don't think it's just a division between, like, well, at least I'm happy with my work regardless of the affirmation I'm getting. I don't think that's how human psychology works. I want people that I care about and people who care about me to enjoy and benefit from what I do. That's part of what it means for me to enjoy my work. It's a communal, it's a relationship thing. I make art. If I'm just doing what I do and I leave it on my computer, if I'm just doing what I do and I just like, I write it in a journal, that's fine. But that's journaling. That's archiving. It becomes art when it's in relationship to other people, which is to say that, like, there is this weird muddy space between, like, affirmation and self-confidence. I want to be self-confident enough to make the thing, but the affirmation I find in other people enjoying it is actually part of it becoming art. So you kind of have to have both.
So that, I think, makes a perfect segue to talking about this whole idea of rejection. You know, you say that rejection, being told no, should be a welcome part of the process of life and business and ministry and art making and growth of all kinds. Getting a no from someone rarely means the end of the road. Hearing yes. No or being denied can be a tremendous gift. How do people find the motivation to keep going in the face of rejection?
That's really good. So the first part of the answer I would want to give from the other side of the people handing out rejection is, if you're in a position of power and you're going to give someone a no, do your best to pass on a few reasons why. So be more helpful about the no's you hand out. So if you're going to say this doesn't work, then, like, it's, you know, say, and here's why. This would have worked better if you this, that, the other. So in the places where I've gotten no's, studio work, where I'll bring something to the table and I'm working with the producer, and, you know, she or he will say, that's actually a bad idea. And then they'll walk me through why, and they'll show me. I'm like, oh, and then I learn and I grow. So the first part of the answer for me has to do with, like, if you're going to delve out no's, if that's part of your job, is you have to say no to people, do it responsibly and lovingly and wisely, and pass along some of those reasons. Then on the other side of that, and that's the story I tell in the book, is, you know, if someone hands you a no, ask. Okay, what was it about this? What could have been better? And maybe you don't get an answer, but, you know, there is a sheer force of will moment here where, like, you really don't have to allow that no to be, like, emotionally definitive. Like, take your punch, because you got punched. That's fine. But then ask why. Like, why is my face so punchable? Like, ask that next question. So, the, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're in the position to hand out no's, then do it responsibly and say, this is why. But if you're getting a no, take the next step and be like, and ask the question, like, okay, what was it that didn't work? Which then takes me back to why. You want to have some concentric circles and spheres of folks who are also paying attention to work, with whom you're in conversation. If all you're doing is creating work in isolation, and which was the story in the book, is this young woman who was writing poetry. And she didn't have a network. She didn't have relationships. She'd been writing poetry. She'd been kind of keeping it on her own. And she had sent some stuff out to, like, the Atlantic and the New Yorker. These are massive magazines. And she got no's. And she was so miffed that she got no's. And I was like, you know, and the audience member says, well, have you considered maybe your work isn't good enough for the New Yorker or the Atlantic? And she couldn't handle that. Part of that is just a general immaturity, is, like, you got to be able to get a no from the freaking New Yorker. Like, you have to, if you're going to be an artist. The other side of the coin is, like, she very clearly then doesn't, I shouldn't say clearly, I would guess that she probably doesn't have a whole lot of folks around her who are helping her refine her work by saying, this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is bad. they might just be a bunch of yes people who are like, everything you make is magical and it is decorated with fairy dust and you're the greatest artist that's ever been and no one make work like you and you're the best. She might be having a lot of friends like that, but she needs to be having friends that are more like, hey, this is good. That was better. And so developing that over the course of time, whether and now it's really easy developing like networks of people on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram who like pay attention to work and then asking for feedback. What do you like about this? What do you not like about this? That's part of how you weed that thing out in you as opposed to, like I said, just creating work and then taking one big swing. Don't do that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been really, really fascinating. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable
Sure.
Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Courage. The courage in an artist and a maker to actually do the thing that's in them, and to not try to do the thing that they're supposed to do or try to do the thing that they to not pull punches. What makes a thing unmistakable is when an artist really recognizes and works at the thing that's actually in them and then puts it in the world and offers it to people. That makes it unmistakable.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
Yeah. So if you just search my name, Justin McRoberts, I'm kind of everywhere on the internet that you want to be, unless you want to be on like, what is it, the Silk Road or whatever, you can buy weapons and what have you. I'm not there. But Instagram is where I spend a lot of my time. I do still like Twitter. I'm on Facebook some. And then my podcast is called At Sea with Justin McRoberts, and we drop episodes every week.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.